So, you know, let's talk a little bit about this stuff, Eric.
Yes, so I was having lunch with Bertrand yesterday, and then he was talking about the sleeping barber algorithm. Hey, Wolfram, you want to join?
Oh, that's fine.
We showed them. This is like Wolfram, Dan, and Ronald Hunter. This is our language, guys.
Outstanding.
So next time, you know, you guys should be on the show as well.
Okay, yeah. Have fun and enjoy.
All right.
About programming languages.
Absolutely.
Okay, so yeah, so we were having lunch and then Bertrand said, you know, yes, I was doing the sleeping barber algorithm and I was like, gee, that's a long time ago. I couldn't even remember. So I got home and I took this book. It's 1983, that's when I bought this book.
Yeah, I think he has a more recent edition.
Yes, and then I even found here that, you know, when I was young, I was a geek. I wrote my own mutual occlusion algorithms, and I was a big fan of Edsger Dijkstra, so I wrote everything handwritten.
So this is for the National Archives?
This is for the National Archives. I don't know if it's correct, but one of the things is that our two guests here are both concurrency experts, or know a lot about concurrency. So let's talk a little bit about concurrency. This book is from 83, and then this was all well known. But if I look at programming languages today, C#, Java, they're still the same. Monitors, semaphores. Why haven't we progressed? I mean, why is it after 25 years that we're still doing stuff from 1983?
Yeah, so that's a pretty good introduction for just about any talk on concurrency these days. Anyway, so before Dijkstra did structured programming and started haranguing the world about how bad their ways were, he did semaphores, which are actually much worse than the go-to in many respects. But we have heeded Dijkstra's call in both respects. We don't use the go-to anymore, but we still use the semaphores, and it's time to move on.
Yeah. So do you have any kind of proposals for, you know, moving this beyond this kind of primitive mechanisms that are described in these books and that we have today?
Yeah, so actually, when you came in, when Yuri came in, I was in the process of writing a grant proposal to Microsoft. Because Microsoft has this multi-core award for people like me who are not at Microsoft, so maybe I can make my grant proposal now, and I don't.
Yes,
have to
why not? Yes.
Go for it.
I don't have to
write it down.
Yeah. But maybe you should ask Yuri his view about concurrency first.
Yes.
I think by and large it's not that much different from Bertrand's, but we have somewhat different tastes.
So can you explain, for example, like here, the idea of abstract state machines for the listeners?
So I'm more interested, or mostly interested, in writing down very abstract algorithms on a high level.
Okay.
So that, forget how do you implement them, so that we can see what the algorithm is supposed to do.
Excellent.
That should be evident from the way it's written. And parallelism is there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not necessarily very efficient. So it works relatively well for specifications. But I think Bertrand is interested in, and you, in parallelism that works very efficiently in practice. That's the difference.
Well, I mean, what are some of the just the core challenges? I mean, the fact of the matter is that programming languages that you guys work in, or at least Eric and most of us here at Microsoft, were created for general purpose use. They weren't created for supercomputing. But now that we're moving into the age of many core, there's the need to provide tools and languages that can actually take advantage of that, right?
One challenge is with us. We are sequential. It's hard for us to think in a parallel way.
Mm.
And you would be surprised how very clever people made very silly mistakes with relatively simple parallel algorithms. mm-hmm. because we think differently, and that matters.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, because actually, but it's not that fashionable. That is to say, many people who look at concurrency mm-hmm. say, oh, concurrency is the way to go, and sequential programming or sequential computing is just a special case, so let's make everything concurrent. And in mm-hmm. fact, I think this is the wrong approach precisely for the reason that you're mentioning, that it's already hard enough to manage our lives if we do one thing at a time, one conscious thing at a time, but we are very bad at multiplexing. And I mean, we do it a little bit, but you know, the best we do is things like playing the piano, which by itself is quite a feat. But the kind of concurrency that we need in our programs is much more complex than that, at a much higher level, and we just don't know how to reason about it. Hmm.
But Bertrand, you must have a little bit more idea, because you know, can you lift a glimpse of, you know, your grant proposal? And because I know that you have done some very interesting work, you know, in the context of IFL, of adding, you know, support for concurrency to the language.
Okay, so I don't need that much more prompt to get started. So the first observation is that, in fact, in sequential programming, we've made a lot of progress in the past 40 years. And if we want to kind of crystallize what this progress is about, it's mostly that we can reason much more about programs and much better about programs. In order to understand what a program does, I'm still in the sequential world at the moment, we don't have to turn ourselves into a computer. So if you think, just to take one small example, pre-go to elimination, post-go to elimination. Pre-go to elimination, in order to understand a program, you must turn yourself into a computer. I'm coming from here, I'm coming from there. Oh no, but the control flow, if this condition was true, could be coming back from here or from there. So this is horrible, and no one can do this. Or more precisely, when very smart people, or, you know, hackers can do it on small programs, but it doesn't scale. And nowadays, even people who have no clue as to, you know, axiomatic semantics or all the beautiful things that people in this building do, have learned to reason about their programs much more abstractly. And this is what we have not achieved for concurrent programming. We still have to, you know, we think in terms of threads and monitors, and actually not even monitors, usually just semaphores, right? So I do a P here, but someone is going to release my log, and so on. So it's horrible, and it doesn't scale. So what we have tried to do with the mechanism that you can enough to allude to, the scoop mechanism, which indeed runs on top of or is added to IFL, and I hope will become the standard part of IFL, is to try to see how little we can add to the sequential frame of mind, to the sequential mindset, to handle concurrency as well, and but not lose this, if I can coin a word, reasonability, you know, ability to reason about our programs, which is really our lifeboat, our lifesaver. Mm-hmm. If we want to be able to deal with big stuff. So that's the overall idea, to try to retain what we understand about programming, mostly, I would say, of course, about object-oriented programming, because there's really no other way I've heard of these little things, I mean, functional this or functional that, which is good, because you can publish papers about that. But there's really nothing. Actually, I'm not completely serious, but that's another discussion. But object-oriented languages are integrating lots of functional mechanisms these days, but it's still the objects that rule, right? Mm-hmm. And so we start from this object-oriented framework, which is the sine qua non, I believe, today. And then you look at the epsilon that you can add in order to get all the performance benefits that we're expecting from all these mega-core, multi-core, many-core, whatever you want to call them, or networks and so on, and still be able to understand what they do. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so and I would really like to kind of drill in a little bit more into this, because
good.
Like one of the great things about IFL, and I think, you know, this is something that, you know, also Jury in kind of, you know, in your context people are doing right with SpecSharp, is to kind of add contracts and pre and post conditions to languages. IFL was one of the languages that pioneered that concept, but you know, can you explain how you're kind of, you know, using contracts to do concurrency? And that's where you have this kind of little epsilon, because I think that's a very elegant approach.
Okay, so you don't need to drill me. very much, but stop me if I go too much into.
No, you cannot. Because the Channel 9 audience loves to kind of, you know, go deep, right, Charles?
Yes, very much so. The deeper, the better.
Okay. Yes.
So I should also say that I did give a talk on the scoop, mechanism here 2 weeks ago, and it's available on somewhere on a server. Okay. One thing I should perhaps also mention, just because you recalled the sleeping barber algorithm, this is indeed what I was looking at yesterday when we had the pleasure of having lunch together with Eric. And every solution that I've seen elsewhere of the sleeping barber has the following elements. First, it has a loop. Well, if you think about it, should it have a loop? I mean, sure. And the reason it has a loop is that at some point it needs to. So maybe we should summarize.
Could you explain first what the algorithm is? Yes. As so Yuri would like, tell us what the algorithm is supposed to do, yes. And then.
well, you say it, I will show the illustration.
So it's actually a very simple problem. It's one of those abstracted, idealized problems that help us a lot to reason about concurrent programming. So there's the dining philosophers, which is probably the most famous, and then you have the cigarette smoker, and you know, look up Wikipedia, you'll find a half dozen of these. So you have a barbershop with five chairs, I mean N chairs, but let's say five chairs, and a barber. And the barber takes care of just one customer at a time. So customers come in. If all the chairs are taken, the customer leaves immediately. And of course, although it doesn't say in the standard description of the problem, he should know that he has not been served. Right? Mm-hmm. And so if a chair is free, he's going to sit in it. And then the barber will do the hair of the customers. And I think we want a fair solution, not in the absolute technical sense of fair, but more in the everyday life sense of fair. That is to say, we probably want the customers to be handled, so to speak,
in the order in which they
arrive. Right? Uh-huh. And so when the customer has been handled, has been served, he just leaves and frees the chair. So it is very simple, but actually it's already enough to. Oh yeah, and I forgot one aspect, which is that if there's no customer,
the barber
goes to sleep. Sleeping barber, and then when a customer again comes in, that's going to somehow to wake up the barber.
Interesting.
So you need to have a good scheduling policy to make sure that this is implemented correctly and, if possible, fairly. And it's not that trivial actually. If you look at published solutions using semaphores, it's actually pretty tricky.
This is the code in good old Pascal. That was the language of the 80s.
Pascal with semaphores?
Yes. It has semaphores. Yeah, and then here's the picture of the barber shop with the chairs, and here's the barber's bed.
That's really interesting.
Yep. So. It's true.
Do you have to account for the customers that walk by, and when they don't see a barber, they immediately leave?
No, the barber is always there.
Okay.
And wakes up immediately.
Wakes up immediately. Before they see him.
Yeah.
He can sense that there's someone looking in, so he'll get up out of his bed and walk into where they can see him. Or there's a window by his bed. Okay.
A vista,
yes. So, in all honesty, let's talk a little bit about how this relates to concurrency.
So, this is concurrent because all these various actors have their own scenarios, if you like, have their own scripts. Mm-hmm. So, you have the customers, you have the chairs, in a way, they have their own threads, mm-hmm. in the ordinary sense of the word thread, and you have the barber. So, they need to synchronize.
Okay.
This is like all these topics, all these example problems. it's representative of the kind of issue that you encounter in operating systems or in other concurrent systems, with various processors or various threads contending for the same resource. So I want to write to the screen. This window wants to do something to the screen. That window, that particular thread wants also to write to the screen, and they shouldn't mess up their outputs. Or on the operating system, and there's a job which wants to go to the printer, and another job that also, another process that also wants to print. Well, we don't want to have one page one line from one of these programs interspersed with lines from others.
Certainly.
So it's pretty typical of these contention topics.
But with Scoot, you can describe this in a much more kind of declarative form, right? Because you don't have to write the kind of loops and taking locks and so on. This is kind of all done in the implementation of the actual mechanism.
Yeah. So I should be a bit careful because we have written actually with Peter Müller, with here we have written a Scoot version of this. Example, and it's the last thing I did today, so that's what I want to talk about. But it's still tentative. But what I like about it is that it states only what I think needs to be stated, and it lets the Scoop implementation take care of the nitty gritty. For example, the loop. It's clear that at some point you must loop to see if there is any request. Coming in, so I guess this is the loop that is in Benary's book. But something that you find in all traditional solutions is that, for example, when the barber is finished with one particular customer, he or she must notify other processes that it's over and they can wake up. And that's what I don't want to do. I want this to be taken care of by the underlying concurrency machinery. So there's no loop in the solution. It's just get the chair on the barber. So there's a barber object, there's a chair object, or I should say five chair objects, barber class. Chair class. There's a customer class and there's a shop class, and they're all kind of separate, which is the technical Scoop term, from each other. They can all run on different threads, and in order to get served, you basically say, hey, shop, serve me. And this particular operation then says, hey, barber, take care of me. But all the scheduling, communication, and synchronization part is taken care of by the underlying machinery. So it's the same way, if you like. It's the same change as when going from machine code to a high-level language with good control structures.
Excellent.
Where someone takes care of the go-tos for you. Or going from, say, Pascal records to classes.
Yep.
It's the same idea that you just go one level up and you let the machinery automatically take care of the details.
Yep. So you get similar things like, if you use a mechanism like joint patterns or something, where also kind of you have suddenly a lot of things that you have to do explicitly with loops and locks and so on, all gets done by the infrastructure, and you just kind of describe the kind of conditions when certain actions can proceed, and then all the waiting and notifying and so on is kind of all taken care of under the covers.
Excellent.
So another thing that in the context of concurrency, that kind of is one a favorite of mine, is kind of transactions, right? So because when we talk now about synchronization, but often you want to kind of do things, and then when there's an error, you want to roll back for me, that's kind of two separate things, right? There's the kind of purely the synchronization of threads, and then there's the kind of atomic updates or doing kind of imperative stuff in isolation. So do you have any kind of
So on that we're not that advanced yet. The basic Scoop mechanism is locking. So whatever operation you do on an object, you need to have it belonging to you, so to speak. So this is already a form of transaction. But we have not built a real transaction mechanism with the ability, for example, to do rollback. So at this point, I don't know yet, but I think it's something that should be built on top of the basic mechanism. I don't see it, for example, as a language mechanism, but I may be wrong. Well, one aspect that is relevant is the Eiffel exception mechanism, which is actually quite different from what you find in most of today's languages, a kind of try-catch machinery. So it's different. It's based on the notion of contract to which you alluded a few moments ago. And it basically says that a routine, a method has something, has a certain contract to perform, an exception is anything that happens that prevents you from performing it. But you still have that duty to perform it. So there's only two outcomes. Either you try again using some other strategy, and then maybe you succeed, or you just give up. You have to restore the invariant, because you should leave the objects in a clean state, and then you pass on an exception to your core. So this is the exception mechanism that Eiffel has, and it's actually pretty close to a transaction mechanism. It's not, but it's close. And this is something that we've also been thinking about, taking this rescue retry mechanism, as it's called, and extended to yield a real transaction mechanism, but we haven't done it yet.
Okay, and in the ASMs, you also have the kind of notion of a kind of atomic transition between.
Yes.
So can you explain how that kind of relates to transactions or kind of
So we have this language called ASML, the language of abstract state machines, and it proceeds in transactions. Every step is a somewhat optimistic transaction. You have a bunch of agents. Each of them makes a move with a hope that there will be no contradiction. And if there is a contradiction, that the whole transaction is rolled back.
Hmm.
And contrary to Bertrand, I recently was working on something else, on security, so my mind is... But maybe I'll say a few words. So, like functional languages in program language theory was a kind of interesting formal approach which altogether contributed quite heavily, though maybe not recognized by everybody.
Mm.
And so we try to do a similar functional/formal revolution in security, and mostly in authorization.
Hmm.
So you have to figure out who is allowed to do what in a highly distributed situation.
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes very just complicated and tedious, because there are many rules, and you have to take all them into account. And of course, you would like a machine to do it for you.
Yes.
And it's quite a logical machine. It looks, what does this rule say? What does that rule say? And what can you derive? And is there any contradiction?
Mm.
And so we try to advance such a declarative approach to authorization and access control in general.
Excellent.
So that's kind of interesting, because I brought some books here, and so I have the first book that I kind of ever bought. That was this book. But the last book that I bought was, guess what?
Ajax Security.
Security. And the funny thing, and so this was exactly the kind of one of the topics that I wanted to bring up, because if you look at the old books, they're all about, fun, right? Little kind of programming exercises, and queens, sorting, permutations. But when I read this book, I can hardly sleep anymore. It's just so scary. But, I don't use the internet anymore, because, I can steal everything. So the question is, just like concurrency, right, is most of our programming languages don't take security into account. In the language itself, yes. So it's like, in some sense, we're now kind of hitting the concurrency problem because of ManyCore, but I think soon we will hit this real security problem as well. So is, in your work, would there be anything coming out there that we as language designers kind of could steal? to make it easier to write secure software?
Currently, the language theory is so much more advanced that it's we who are stealing ideas from language theory. Mm-hmm. But there are some interesting developments. So in the field of security, there are very basic problems that needs to be addressed. Mm-hmm. For example, what's identity? What's your identity?
But that's a problem that we also have in object programming. Right? What is object identity? People can talk for weeks about that and don't come to agreement. Right. Yeah.
But what's your identity as a user? Or mm-hmm. what's identity of this server or some other third forces there? Mm. And you can go all the way to deep philosophy and Kant and so on. Obviously, it's wrong. Mm-hmm. So we have to be, on one side, deep in understanding this basic notion. On the other side, very pragmatic. For example, I would not like to discuss what's identity of Eric. I would rather discuss what's identity of this particular account of Eric. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, it relates to the identity of object, because there is always something like a string. There's some piece of data which can be taken as the ideal manifestation of identity. And then there are notions like trust. Mm-hmm. What does it mean? What does trust mean? And certainly trust is not Boolean. It's not just you trust or don't trust. You trust more, you trust less.
Yep.
So we have one of the researchers here, Yakov Jacobi, who develops a theory of many-value trust. In my little team, we prefer to stay away from general notion of trust. We have only very, very small, disciplined version of trust. Principle A, trust principle B on this particular little matter, X. And that's the only way we use trust. And then there is an axiom. So if A trusted B on X, and B says X, then also A accepts this X.
So this sounds very similar to kind of type systems, just like function application, what you're describing here. So is there a relationship between this notion of trust and kind of, types in the sense of, that we use in programming languages?
It definitely is. Let's see, what's a functional language in a nutshell? You want to evaluate your program. Ideally, without executing it. Now, when you really try to do this, there's a lot of problems. And the state somehow comes in different ways. Now, here we have, in a sense, even more declarative situation. Because there are all these business rules. And right now, in this particular state of affairs, I have to figure out if I... owner of this resource, and you want this resource, do you deserve it or not? So our own approach builds on the notion of knowledge. So I give you this resource if I can derive from the information available to me that indeed I know as a result of derivation, not necessarily a priori, that you are entitled to this reserve, to this resource. So there are very interesting parallels between functional approach to languages. And for me personally, it's a kind of jump. All my life I was, big portion of my life when I worked, I was not in a functional language territory. Hmm. I was... very much in the imperative world. Try to make a point that usually when people say declarative, what they really mean abstract and not necessarily declarative, but you can be imperative and very abstract. But the current stage in the access control theory is such that a purely declarative approach there is a room for it.
Yes, 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 and I agree. And this is, I think, where you know your types have to be really precise. They have to say everything about your program that yes. that is true. So uh-huh. we talked about this before.
We have.
Yes. So Bertrand, sir, talking about type systems.
Talking about side effect free
type systems. Yes, yes. Yeah. No, but so Eiffel also, as you know, we mentioned it very briefly. You know, the contracts and pre and post conditions. But that's also. A very interesting kind of form of type systems, because normally, you know, if you look at, you know, let me show you another book. This is my kind of, you know, my first book on object-oriented programming. Actually, before I got your book, this is like, you know.
Well, so this is about object-oriented programming.
Well, I think so. It's 1996. Well, but anyway, if you look at here, types like here or in C sharp. Mm-hmm. They say, you know, this method takes an integer and it returns an integer. But those types are not very expressive, right? Because, you know, what does it tell you, right? You know, it's an integer, it returns an integer. But in Eiffel, the types are much more expressive, right? Because, you know, you can specify contracts and pre and post conditions. So can you kind of, you know, explain a little bit of why that's kind of, you know, what the advantages are and the values that you get out of this, like, you know, with... in respect to testing and things like that. I think you've done tremendously interesting work leveraging exactly contracts.
Okay, so I'll try to explain this for the next 2 hours. the basic idea is more like 2 minutes than 2 hours. It's like many good ideas, it's totally trivial initially. It's the idea that when you write software, you're not just writing lines of code, but you're actually trying to solve problems. Actually, I could almost stop there. Any element of the software is there to solve a certain part of the problem, right? Mm-hmm. And so, it should say not only what it does, but why it does it, what it is trying to address. So the description of what it is trying to address is known as a contract. Technically, it comes in three basic forms. There are a few more variants. You can have a precondition, which says what the piece of software expects from the rest of the world. You can have a postcondition. You should have a postcondition, which states what it's returning to the promising, providing to the rest of the world. So that's a postcondition. And then there's something which actually is common to a number of operations, which is known as an invariant, which is the basic properties of safety, of consistency of the world that everyone is supposed to maintain. So, you know, we make ourselves totally unbearable by always asking the same three questions. What does this thing expect? What does this thing guarantee? What does it maintain? So precondition, postcondition, class invariant. And so why do we do this? Well, partly it is to make ourselves unbearable, but it's also because this helps kind of throughout the software process. Mm-hmm. It helps get the stuff right in the first place, because very often you thought you knew what you were trying to do. But in fact, when you actually state it, when you spell it out, you realize that you're not doing exactly what you thought you were doing, or you didn't quite know what you were doing. This is particularly true with invariants. Just the intellectual effort of stating what your invariants are, yes. what are the relationships between the various pieces of your software. Just this kills right away in many bugs before they've had the time to become bugs. Mm-hmm. So that's one application, getting things right in the first place. Second application, documenting that stuff. Because then, once you've made that effort and put these contract elements into the code, well, then you have your work cut out for you with respect to documentation. Basically, the documentation consists of extracting those elements and getting rid of the code. So in Eiffel, that's what we have. There's something known as the contract view, which essentially produces the documentation for the software from the software itself. So, you know, documentation is something that no one wants to write. So, and those who could write it, say the technical writers, they are not qualified in general to do program documentation. They can do user documentation, but only the programmer could write the program documentation. And I don't know about you, but most of the programmers I meet are better at writing programs than at writing documentation.
Yes.
And actually, when we meet a programmer who really wants to write documentation, maybe we can be a bit concerned where he or she is technically. So this is a really big benefit,
yes,
the documentation. Mm-hmm. Then you also have your tests more or less ready for you. Because you can enable these things. You can enable monitoring of these things at runtime, during testing, during debugging, and it's unbelievable how often you write something, you know, precondition, postcondition, an invariant, maybe because your boss is looking over your shoulder and has told you that you should write them, but you think, you know, in the deep of your heart, there's no way this thing could ever possibly break, right? It's so trivial. And then you run the program, and then sure enough, the first time you run it, and it happens to me like to everyone else, right? The first time you run in one of these things that could never, ever possibly two centuries breakdown, breaks. You know? So it's a fantastic tool for debugging. In ITTH, we have this research project, Autotest, which actually goes beyond by making tests completely automatic, by creating the objects. And so you just go to lunch and go and come back and find your contract's broken, basically, your bug's evidence.
So it creates the tests from the contracts.
It creates the tests from the classes, so it generates all kinds of objects, and then it creates the test oracles from the contracts.
Yes.
So it just waits for a postcondition or an invariant to fail, which always signals a discrepancy between what you thought the program would do and what it actually does. Then, to continue with the answer to your question, what does this do for us? I won't go into the details, but it makes it possible to understand inheritance. I would claim that you don't understand inheritance until you understand the associated rules on contracts, and maybe it's an excellent idea for your listeners and viewers to buy a copy of this excellent book, which you can get on Amazon for a price which is really low for
such a quality product.
such a weighty as I mentioned before, it helps you get exceptions right. It helps managers, because managers can kind of look at the software at a sufficiently abstract level without having to dive into the code, and I'll spare you the 257 further advantages of getting of using contracts. I mean, it will cure bad breath. It will make you more attractive to the opposite sex.
Wow!
But here's a question, though. I mean, and this is I've asked Eric about this based on the conversation we had before about side effects and I won't say, you know, truthful type systems, because I don't really like that terminology, mm-hmm. the notion of trust. But why is it that in the real world, the general purpose programmer, the majority of people who write software for companies and for money and that we all use on all of our products, are not writing this type of stuff? I mean, what's going on here?
So, you know, there's, according to reliable estimates, something like 6.2 billion people in the...
I have a meeting.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. And
a great pleasure. Thank you.
It's great to meet you.
Bye.
Good luck with the security stuff, huh?
Thank you.
All right.
Well, we're counting on you.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's something like 6.2 billion people in the world, and you just pick the one person who is the worst person to ask this question. I mean, the question of why are not more people?
Well, I guess really...
I'm just the wrong person to answer that question.
Sure, I mean, I don't think there's really an answer.
I mean, it's just kind of interesting if you look at how the adoption of programming languages, the evolution of the adoption, it's all tending towards what's turned out to bite us in the end, right? With security problems and productivity problems. We are trying to make a difference, though, with Java and C# and VB.NET. It makes it easier for people to get... I mean, that's one of the things I think we forget about sometimes is that there's also this notion of productivity. I'm a developer. There's an algorithm I have to write. I want to get it done. I want to get it done in 8 hours and not 36 hours.
But the question is, do you want to get it done or do you want to get it right? I think that's probably the problem. That's exactly the problem, is that we confuse productivity with, you know, getting it done quickly. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, you know, if your language, your programming environment can help you prevent bugs or find bugs and so on, that is, I think, real productivity. Mm-hmm. But I think we're confusing that, saying, oh, let's hack something, you know, together quickly. Oh, I'm done. But then we don't count all the hours that it takes to debug, and maybe even later when we already deployed the software to kind of, you know, handle the bugs. So it's like, you know, we're probably doing the wrong accounting, I think, you know, when we're doing programming.
Yeah, this is all absolutely true. True people don't see the real productivity picture. But there's also something which goes beyond this. And, I mean, the short answer to your question, or the blunt answer to your question, is because people, to your initial question, why are not more people using these techniques? Mm-hmm. The answer is that not enough people are using iPhone. And I realize this is a very pretentious answer, but I believe it's correct. And the point here is that, in the end, writing contracts, keep it between ourselves, mm-hmm. but it's not such a big deal. It's really not such a big deal. It's not like it's not, for example, formal specification in the kind of approach where you have to spend 2 months describing the complete formal specification, mathematical specification of your program before you actually produce a line of code. That is not it. It's something that is actually, designed by contract, is really something that is an increment on the usual ways of writing software. And of course, as you get into it, you'll do more, but starting it's really not such a big effort. And most contracts that people will write, especially initially, tend to be pretty simple affairs. You know, this variable has to be positive, that file has to be open, this particular pointer shouldn't be void. So it's not like complicated, sophisticated contracts. And then what happens usually is that people write these small things, and then at some point they hit a really major bug, they discover a really major bug because of one of these contracts having gone wrong. And then they kind of experience this conversion experience. They realize that it's useful, and then at that point they will start writing more sophisticated contracts, although again not requiring a PhD in mathematics. It's just going to be relatively simple things. But there's this kind of impression that it must be difficult, it must be complicated, it must require a PhD in mathematics. And the reason I'm saying not enough people use Eiffel is that since in Eiffel the whole thing is built in, it's not something that you have to add, you don't have to use a special namespace, a special library, a special preprocessor, whatever. Well, people, even if initially skeptical or reluctant, are naturally led to use these mechanisms. And there have been studies. There's a study by Patrice Chalin at Concordia in Canada, who has surveyed the actual use of Eiffel in university and in industries, mm-hmm. and his result is basically that people do use the associate, something like the contracts, so something like 4 to 6% of lines of code are contracts. So once these are not all geniuses. I mean, I shouldn't say this. Okay, cut this. But they're all geniuses, of course. But they're geniuses in their own ways. They're not necessarily programming geniuses. Okay, or programming professionals for that matter. They just get into this because they find it's useful. And so the real myth to dispel is that this is rocket science, because it's not.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. And also, I think a lot of people that do test-driven development, really what they want is they want to use contracts. They do it in a very primitive way. So talk about that. So one of the things that, you know, I just got this book this morning or yesterday night out of my bookshelf. And, you know, I had this kind of, you know, and I didn't know what this was, why I put this kind of yellow sticky here.
Uh-huh.
But one of the interesting things, I think, is that this is like, you know, reality, a cousin twice removed. Oh, yeah. Yes, so that is one of the things, is like modeling, right? That's now very much in fashion. But if you read the old literature about object-oriented programming, that was all about, you know, objects, model, the real world, and so on. So what has happened? Why is, you know, is modeling now suddenly not object-oriented programming anymore? And why should modeling ever be object-oriented programming? Yeah. So what does modeling mean in your vision?
So the point that this particular section makes, and actually the editor wanted to remove that section. But
it's my favorite section of the book, so...
several people said, you know, cut it, it's just verbiage and so on. But I kept it. So the point that this particular section makes is that it's a delusion to think that you are writing a model of reality. You're actually writing a model of a model of reality. Because reality is, I mean, I don't want to go into deep philosophical speeches, you know, it's Plato versus Aristotle or whatever, but the reality, to use the cliché, is in the eyes of the modeler.
Yes.
The beholder. And so what we're doing in object-oriented programming is taking some part of reality that is of interest to us, and we're modeling that part. And actually, the real basis of the object-oriented approach is to say, I don't care what you are, so I only care what you can do for me, right? So it's this abstract data type approach where you say an object is defined by the applicable operations. Well, if I take the object Eric Meyer, it has a lot of operations, and right now I'm not interested in all of these operations. I'm only interested in those that are relevant to me, like nodding, for example, which is a very efficient operation, something that you do really well. And and this is true of object-oriented design, modeling in general. So this is the particular point that this section is trying to make. But to go a bit deeper into this issue of modeling, the idea of object-oriented programming, as I see it, and certainly the idea of Eiffel, is that you don't want to have the distinction between the model and the implementation of that model.
Exactly. So this is exactly what I wanted to ask you, because now if you're already, you know, your program is already kind of, you know, an abstraction of a model of the real world. Now if I'm already now modeling, you know, at a separate layer, now I'm just introducing yet another kind of, you know, layer of abstraction. So now my model is kind of really three times removed. So yes, I mean, I find that kind of quite disconcerting too, that, you know, we're trying to kind of move this modeling more and more away from, you know, what we're really trying to model by adding all these layers.
Right, and so at this point we're sufficiently far in the interview that only the nerds are
still here. Still
yes, yes,
right. So I can afford to say unpleasant things, right? So my view of the history is... of the history of the world is about this. There used to be very low-level programming. So people came up with things like COBOL and such, claiming they were high-level, and they were not high-level enough. So, and no reasonable person wanted to think in COBOL or Fortran. I mean, pick your favorite language, circa 1965, right? So quite naturally, and I would say reasonably, others came up with higher level modeling notations, typically like structured analysis, structured design, not to be confused with structured programming, but basically graphical notations to describe the overall structure of your program. It was very useful. I mean, if the alternative is assembly language or COBOL, you want something more high level. And then came, I'm really talking a long, long time ago, then came Simula 67 and object-oriented programming. And this completely changed the picture although very few people understood this, and I would say not everyone understands it today yet. But the creators of object-oriented programming, the real creators of object-oriented programming, that is to say, Christian Nygaard and Ole Johan Dahl from Norway, understood this very well. You know, Christian Nygaard, they both died in a few years ago.
Yes,
but until his death, Christian Nygaard, who was the more vocal of the two, would make the point again and again. And actually, the last time I heard and saw him, it was in fact in Zurich, and he had come with his initial report on Simula, whose cover said Simula 67, a programming and modeling language. So he understood this right from the start, in 1966 or something like that, 67 maybe, yeah, it must be 67. So basically what they said, you don't need to be ashamed of the programs. And of the programming level. You can make the level of abstraction sufficiently high that we can talk about the world in terms of programming languages. That's not exactly the way they phrased it, but that was the natural conclusion, to use the right word. And this, to me, is really the revolution of object-oriented programming, is that you can have programming languages that are high-level enough, expressive enough, also simple and clean enough, that in the end you don't need anything else. You don't need design languages. You don't need Babel and Arrow notations, except maybe as another view of the same information. And to me, this is very much what Eiffel in particular is about. I started from the similar ideas and made them more complete, more modern, also, try to correct the deficiency that I had found with Simula, because I had used the language a lot. But this is what it's about. So it's a language to think about the world. But then what was very interesting to witness was that when object technology, which until the first Uppsala had been a kind of well-kept secret, suddenly exploded to the world, then it panicked quite a few people, in particular all these people who were used to thinking that we need several layers of description, also meaning jobs in a way, consultants. And so they really panicked, and they felt that they couldn't find their marbles anymore, so to speak. And it took a few years to come back to what I would call the old order, in which you have programming language, and then you have the design language, and then you have the analysis and design notations. And this is really, to me, what UML is about. But you don't need it, right? You don't need something like this, except as one representation. Sometimes it's true that you want to see pictures more than you want to see text. You want to be able to go back and forth between the two. But the reference should always be in the text. And if you have a sufficiently high-level language, that text should be in the programming language. So MDA and such, some of the ideas are very interesting, but basically it is this old idea of the split, the gap between the idea and the realization. And one thing that we know in software is that whenever you introduce a gap, you're in trouble, because software changes. So if you have two models, two views, the model and the implementation, then as soon as anything changes, then you are going to have incompatible views, and this is the end of it. And so when people, we often hear about people who have this some kind of a model-driven tool. The question always to ask them, always ask it, is, okay, you have this high-level stuff, and then they tell you they generate whatever, Java, C#, whatever, from it. So the question to ask is, okay, I assume you have bugs, so they will reluctantly admit it. When people develop software, usually these are very enthusiastic presentations, so people will not immediately admit that they have, that sometimes they have bugs, but their users have bugs. But so the question is, where do you debug? And of course you have to push people a little bit before they answer the question honestly. So they'll admit that they were going to debug the generated code, for the good reason that they do not have a complete development environment for the source language. Okay? There are only two possibilities: either they debug the generated code, in which case the approach, I would say, will not work, because then you start debugging, you start changing, and then the model quickly follows the fate of many UML descriptions. I mean, the drawer, right? The file cabinet. So in that case, I would say model-driven development doesn't work. Or in rare cases, people will have developed a complete development environment, browser, debugger, everything, but then it's just... maybe it's called model-driven development, but it's just another high-level, maybe a better, higher-level language. But this idea of splitting the idea and the concretization, the reification, as some people say, of the idea, to me, is absolutely antithetic to the central principle, one of the central principles of software engineering, which addresses one of the central issues of software engineering, namely change. So was that a long enough sentence?
Yes. No, that's... I kind of, you know... I really also believe that, you know, that the code is the kind of, you know, that should be the your kind of, you know, the center of everything and kind of trying to split this. But so for some reason people, you know, think that, you know, by drawing pictures, it might be easier to, you know, you don't write code, so you don't have to deal with concurrency, maybe, because there's no code. Yeah.
Or you can describe concurrency in very simple terms, but then the difficulty is not the overall structure in general.
Yes.
It's beta races and deadlocks and contentions. Yeah.
But I would ask, as you guys are talking, I'm thinking through history, and I'm seeing that you were saying, you know, once you wrote machine code, and you wrote assembler, then you go up maybe to something else, and then C, then C++, and then Java, and then .NET, you know, whatever. But then as the languages keep getting higher and higher, I mean, why couldn't you just have a language just, as Yuri was sort of alluding to, is just purely declarative kind of...
I don't know, definitely, but the thing is, it's still a language.
That's what I'm saying. So the modeling component could still be a language, right?
Yeah. Yes.
That's what it is, but it has a precise semantics. These graphical notations do not have a precise semantics.
Okay, so you're talking about modeling, graphical modeling versus declarative sort of modeling, where you would, instead of writing a line of C++ or a line of C#, you would write some other sort of construct, some simple sentence structure that would mean, I plan on doing this.
Well, in some
That's
sense,
what I'm saying.
Yes, but I think, you know, if I paraphrase what Bertrand was saying, is that modeling is just programming, and you know it's you know if you, whether you call it modeling or programming, it's you're really programming. It's like you're describing the world and the operations in the world, and you know that might be a higher level or kind of lower level, but you know you don't want to have kind of two separate notions where you model and then you implement.
Okay. So now let's talk a little bit about, you know, like
I mean I don't. I hope.
That's a good paraphrase. I mean, that was a good. But I do.
He's much more concise than I am.
Well, because he's into functional programming, right? He's like his he writes like you know 5-line programs that do lots of things.
Yeah.
But let's talk about accept things that are useful. Oh, just kidding. Just joking. So let's talk a little bit about that because Eric is very much into this notion of. The need for more mathematical languages. So more sort of languages that look more like math. Functional languages need to be adopted in the mainstream as opposed to making imperative languages more functional. Just start using functional languages. Mm-hmm. But so, Michael, I would like to ask your take on, you know, what do you think about the notion of programming languages need to become math... Programmers need to become more like mathematicians. What do you make of that concept?
So, I must say, you know, so I have nothing against functional languages. Some of my best friends do functional languages. We use functional languages. If my daughter wanted to marry someone who does functional programming, well, actually, that one is a bit more. It's a bit happy. But actually, more seriously, one of the things that really brought me to programming, and I knew I was going to be a computer scientist, but really to specialize in programming was this course on Lisp. By McCarthy at Stanford, so by the creator of Lisp and working at AI Lab. So for 1 year, I wrote nothing but Lisp code, probably pretty bad Lisp code, but Lisp code anyway. So I'm very sensitive to the elegance of functional programming, and certainly I admire very much all the progress that has been made with, you know, successive languages, from Miranda to Haskell, of course, and others. So it's something which is very attractive intellectually. What I do believe, and I'm at some, well, maybe the word belief is wrong, because I hope it's more, it's partly based on experience and analysis, is that the concept of state is absolutely fundamental. That you, that, so that I don't, I refuse, if you like, the identification between the following two oppositions. One, more mathematics versus less mathematics. The second one, functional versus whatever you want to call it, procedural imperative. I want more mathematics in a completely imperative context. I see absolutely no contradiction between those two, those two aspects. So, for example, in the Eiffel programming style, which is very different actually from, in this respect, from the programming style that's dominant in object-oriented programming today, there's this business of command query separation. And it's a very simple idea. It says you have commands and you have queries. So command does something to an object or to the state in general, and a query just returns information. But when you have a query, it should not change the state. So asking a question doesn't change the answer. That's the short way of putting it. So the place where we part with functional programming people is the very acceptance of the notion of command. Okay, but because I guess at least a purist functional programmer would say that we only want queries, right? So this, to me, is too extreme. I think there's absolutely nothing wrong with commands. But it should be clear whether you have a command or you have a query. So, for example, you will never use a function in the standard C style which does something and then returns a result. You know, have a command that does something, and then maybe one or many queries that ask the object about the state in which it is as a result of this command. So, and this can be specified mathematically just about as rigorously as anything else.
So I think actually that there's more correspondence than, you know, contradiction. You know. Of course, you as the kind of journalist, you know, you want to kind of stir controversy. But I think really there is very little controversy, because I think both in, like, you know, in Eiffel and in the functional language, you're trying to, when we talk about model, you're trying to model the world in a very precise way by having expressive types, like in Eiffel with pre and post conditions, and as Bertrand says, by having this distinction between queries and commands. This is exactly what you would do in Haskell, where you kind of have the kind of, you know, pure types, you know, functions, and then you have things that are kind of in the monadic world that corresponds to commands. So you distinguish between the two as well. Mm-hmm. And also you're trying to make your types more precise by making them more expressive, not saying, you know, it's just something that takes an integer and returns an integer. No. You want to say more. So just like in Eiffel, where you say it's a precondition that the integer must be positive. Well, in Haskell, we don't have, well, there's proposals for contracts, but also we try to make the type systems very expressive, such that they are very precise about, you know, the intent or the meaning, the semantics of your code. So I do think that there's, you know, that there's not that much of a contradiction. The other thing I think is, if you look at Eiffel in particular, where, you know, all methods are virtual, right? So, and a class with virtual methods is very much like a higher order function, because, you know, if I hand you a class that has virtual methods, now, you know, I can always provide a subtype that has specializations of these things. So it's really like passing you, you know, a function that has the implement, that, you know, well, the closure with all the implementations. So it's very, you know, the ways you program are very similar. And in Eiffel, you also have, like, something like delegates or agents, right, as you call them.
Yeah, so actually, yeah, this is an important point to mention. Yeah. Functional languages have been very successful in some way, in a way that most people don't realize. It's not that by having the unwashed masses use Haskell or the scheme or whatever. But it's by, it's more by having influenced almost all recent object-oriented languages. So in C sharp, you have delegates, and now you have, of course, all the work that has been done in Link and such. In iFlow, you have this agent mechanism, which really is a kind of mini functional language embedded in an object-oriented language. So this is the way. I mean, I was saying earlier that objects rule, and I really believe this, because I don't see that functional languages have that much to contribute to the matter of overall structure of programs. You know, this is really where objects, or I should say classes, provide the best known solution, and I'm even willing to bet that we're not going to see anything much better in the next decade or two. So for this, I think for the overall structure, it's classes and objects. But when it comes to the actual programming mechanism, one of the most interesting phenomena in the past 10 years has been this invasion, so to speak, this percolation is a better word, percolation of functional ideas into mainstream object-oriented languages, and this has made expressiveness much, much higher. In iFlow, I don't think we would program without agents anymore.
Yeah. So the way I look at this, that you define, like, you know, it's like your bricks. You define them using objects and methods and state, and then you glue them together. So the functional programming is good, very good as a glue. Mm-hmm. So, and that's, you know, then you kind of decompose it.
So I mean, if you want controversy, it is quite interesting that you're saying this, because to me it's exactly the reverse. You know, objects for the structure, or classes for the structure, object-oriented concept for the structure, but inside, sneaky intrusions, or not so sneaky intrusions, of functional ideas and mechanisms and constructs.
Okay, so maybe this controversy is a nice way to kind of conclude, you know, absolutely, to leave it open. It's like a cliffhanger. So
yeah.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yes, okay, fantastic. Well, thank you very much.
You. Awesome, great to meet you.
Pleasure was
definitely
mine. Okay. And by the way, Eric, that's quite a shirt. It's not your typical tie-dye. What's going on?
Yeah. So I went to France last week, and then, you know, they said, well, you should upgrade from these tie-dyes to, you know, some real sophisticated shirts. So I went to, you know, a kind of boutique in Paris, and I got some new shirts. So in the next couple of, you know, whenever I appear on Channel 9, I will show off my French shirts. I bought, I think, 6 or 7, so, wow. And they're all very colorful, so it's
outstanding.
Yep. I was going to use, when we started talking about concurrency, I was going to use your shirt as an example, but the discussion is some other way, so it's going to have to be for next time.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, everybody out there, there's a book for you to go buy.
Well,
and
or another one also by Bertrand. This is like, yeah, it's very nice too. Yeah.
Very nice. Maybe I'll buy this book.
Yep.
Be better for my next interviews.
All right.
Hey, great to meet you. Thank you so much. Thanks.